Hello and welcome to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, the original international talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. I'm Jonathan Mosen, and indeed we certainly have an international flavour today because this program is coming to you from Bangkok in the Kingdom of Thailand. It's being recorded over a number of days. We're beginning recording it on Friday the 21st of September, and the reason why we're here is because it's the first General Assembly of the newly reconstituted World Blind Union Asia Pacific region. And I'm here as one of the delegates to New Zealand, and we will be attending the various functions associated with the Assembly and doing the business, but also of course it's a chance for us to catch up with people from around the Asia Pacific region of the World Blind Union and experience a bit of Thailand. And also here on the program, it's a bit of a treat because we've got my wife Amanda Mosen here as well. So welcome, Amanda.
Thank you.
What's been happening?
Well, retail therapy's been happening big time.
Yes, it's amazing. We were talking about what to do, and I was a bit reluctant to head into a shopping mall because I figured, well, you don't want to come to a place like Thailand and just wander around a shopping mall. But actually, it's like no other shopping mall.
It's amazingly fantastic, this particular shopping mall.
Yeah, so tell us about why it's so fantastic.
It's on 7 levels, and each one, just to walk around, takes about half an hour if you don't happen to be looking at anything, and considerably longer if you're actually window shopping or, better still, spending up large. It's very most of it's very reasonably priced, and it's amazing. They're all a lot of little shops, and they're almost like stalls.
Yeah, they're sort of like a market inside.
It is.
In an air-conditioned environment, which certainly in this climate is much appreciated.
And like on one level, no, I think it's actually on two levels, they're really into cell phones. And there is...
Quite right too.
there would be at least 50 or 60 little stalls or little shops that sell cell phones and cell phone accessories and anything that you can think of to do with a cell phone. And they're all priced slightly differently, and if you want to get the best buy, you have to go from one to another until you find what it is that you're actually looking for at the cheapest price, and then you go back to the cheapest one. So, yeah it's a great atmosphere. It's a lot of fun.
It is, and even at the expensive end of the spectrum, we're talking about bargain basement prices. I managed to pick up a Motorola battery for the L series phone that I have, and the lowest price we found was 450 baht. The baht is the Thai currency. That works out, I'm just trying to do the sums in my head, must be about 25 New Zealand dollars, right? Because about 900 baht is 50.
That's right.
So that would be around about 10 or 11 US dollars for a genuine Motorola battery. This is not just something that happens to fit the Motorola phone. It's the real McCoy. And then we picked up a cell phone desktop charger for a really cheap price as well. Electronics, you know, a really impressive looking and sounding amplifier for a home theatre system with all of the bells and whistles that you expect in that sort of device. We're talking about under 100 US dollars for a really, you know, two microphone inputs and everything like that. They had
Toshiba components, I believe.
Yeah, and MP3 players that go into your rack system so that they will play MP3 CDs, and they play DVDs and CDs often in a combo situation, going really cheap as well. So it's fun. We are having, this is the place for me. And
the people are great.
They are. Everybody's friendly. Communicating can be a bit of an experience. How much, I mean, obviously, and I noticed this before when we've gone to countries where English isn't the first language, the ability to gesticulate makes a big difference, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It definitely does, yes. Although the people here are managing, you know, their English is not too bad. I mean, it's limited, but it's enough to get by in a conversation about most things.
Yeah, and certainly people know what how much means.
Yes, and they're very good at actually typing it into their little calculators and showing you the screen. So if you can't understand what they're saying, they show you the little screen with the number of baht coming up on the screen because they typed it into their calculator for you.
Okay, yeah, well that's pretty nifty. We've got some great children's toys as well. A doll that says mummy and daddy and crawls around and is very active. I mean, it's just amazing the cost of things and the variety.
A digger has got a remote. Well, it's not exactly remote. I suppose it is a remote control, but it's attached by a wire. But it's got, you can make the digger itself move forwards and backwards. Or it's got three tiny little joysticks, I guess is the best way to describe them, on the remote control thing. And you can make it lift up its digger thing. And I'm not quite sure what the third one does, but it looks really quite exciting.
So retail therapy. Also, I should mention that what we're using to record this program, we've got the new IBM ThinkPad here, doing a fine job it is too. And that ThinkPad, for those who are interested in such things, it weighs about 1.4 kilos. I don't know what that is in pounds,
it's
under 3
about
pounds.
Three, yes.
Yeah. And it's about an inch thick. It's really a nifty device, nice and light. And plugged into it, we have something that we also picked up at this amazing mall today, which is actually just attached to the hotel, so it's in real easy access, which is good because we've been taking, you know, huge loads of stuff back, going out again. the microphone headset that I'm using now is a genuine Sony article. With it has a windsock on the microphone. Very high quality headsets that go right over your ears, are sort of hugging, keep the noise out, which is great when you're trying to record in a noisy environment. And that was something like about $12 for this. And it's extremely good quality, with a frequency response of 20 to 20. So
no, it's 14 to 20, isn't it?
No, that the one we were looking at was yes, you're right. No. Yeah, 15. Yeah, 15. Starts at 15. Yep. So that's right.
We were looking at 20,000.
Yeah, we were looking at another one that started at 20 at the bottom end. So that's good. On the shadier side, they do have a section of this mall that sells pirated software, and I presume that means that the copyright laws in Thailand are more relaxed than many other countries. For example, you can pick up a copy of Microsoft Office Professional for about $10 US,
and that would be 1900 New Zealand dollars to buy the real version at home.
Yeah, it's about that. So they also have other, or pretty much any piece of software that you want. And what happens is that if you did want to go ahead and buy a copy of this, apparently what you do is you hand over your money, they tell you to go away. It's a bit like ordering a pizza, you know, when you go into the store and order one, and they tell you to come back in 15 minutes and your software is waiting for you. So I guess that one of the downsides of all that is that it's no wonder that copy protection is starting to come back into vogue, not just with certain screen reader vendors, but also you see some copy protection being introduced into Windows XP, which is to be released shortly, and you can sort of understand why if you can just wander up and pick these things up.
However, they had on display software that we have at home, that we have the genuine McCoy article of. That ours is copy protected, like the Microsoft Office suite, and yet they seem to be selling that. I don't know what they're doing, but
I guess it's a crack of some description. So that's it's a big industry. I mean, it's not just one stall. You can wander around and there's a whole section there,
and each of the stalls has thousands of titles.
Yeah, okay. And did you find any computer hardware?
No, I didn't. I'm very sorry. I think we might have to go outside of the mall itself. It seems to be very focused on certain things. It's got a lot of clothing and a lot of cell phones. An awful lot of cell phones. And there's a huge food court.
Huge.
Massive food court. Huge. And the top level is the top level that you didn't come to, Jonathan. This is a very interesting place. It would be a place to go with your mini disc recorder, actually. They have a big cinema complex up there. But they also have heaps of these like booths in which you can go and check your internet, check your email and things. And they've also got lots of places where you play these PlayStation video type games, and you actually go in there and you play them there. And one of them is out in the centre of the mall area on that level, and it's got these massive screens. They'd be, thinking American wise, I suppose, 4 or 5 foot across and 3 or 4 foot high.
Goodness gracious.
Massive screens, and people actually sit on a chair that's attached to the whole thing, and they can push their buttons and what have you. And I guess because it's such a big screen, it looks like you're really there, and it's very real, and it's very, very loud.
How excellent. We should see if we can wander up with a mini disc machine.
Yeah. There's also this up there, there's also some more restaurants, and there's one that I saw that I thought looked really interesting. It's called something barbecue something, and I can't remember the exact detail of it. But at each table, it's got a cooking machine, for want of a more descriptive title, that has it's round, and it's obviously hot, and it's got hot fat or oil or something around the edge of it. It's kind of shaped like a hat that's got a brim, so it goes up in the middle and then it widens out into like a brim, but then it's got a lip at the edge of the brim.
Right.
And you cook your food in the brim part, and they bring to you, I was watching some people through the window, and they bring to your table whatever, I'd say they have different dishes that you can order with different combinations of food, and they bring it in and you cook it yourself at the table on this machine and take it out and eat it.
We went to a restaurant like that in New York, didn't we?
No, that was different again. That was where they had a big barbecue thing and the Japanese chef came along and he cooked it in front of us.
Okay.
But this is a smaller machine and you cook it yourself. The people who are actually dining do the cooking.
Mm. We're off to, we're not here to shop, by the way, and in fact in 20 minutes time as we record this, we are off to begin the evening's festivities for the beginning of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific Regional Assembly, which includes an address by the Deputy Prime Minister of Thailand. And one thing that was really impressive is the way that the Thai people have got behind this. The volunteers here have been just amazing. We got off the plane at about 11:15 in the evening, and even then it was 27 degrees Celsius. I think that's in the upper 80s, if I remember correctly, in the Fahrenheit, which I think America's the only one left using it, aren't they? But anyway, but 27 degrees Celsius, that's hot, man. I mean, at night time. And we were met, and because we were identified as being World Blind Union people, we were fast-tracked. There's a huge line. And you were saying that the size of the Bangkok airport, and you've seen a lot of the major American airports,
it would compare well with Chicago.
Yeah, the O'Hare airport. Yeah. Well, very large. Air-conditioned, thankfully, because, man, it's really hot and humid here.
And there aren't enough air bridges for all the, like, there would be an excess of 100 air bridges, but there weren't enough for all the planes that were stopping. And so we got met by this big bus thing that you stand up inside
and hold on to a handle that's dangling from the roof.
There are a few seats, but we were the last ones on, so we were hard out of luck.
It'd be quite fun to swing from, actually.
But you stand up in it, or sit down in it, as the case may be, and you get taken over to a door that is like your gateway, I suppose, and you go up to and go through your passport control, and then you go and get your suitcases, and it's very, very big, and yeah, there's even within each little, there are heaps of terminals, and within each terminal there are lots of planes coming in. There were like three or four coming into our terminal, and they each have their own carousel that's going around with the bags for the particular flight that you've been on.
Yep, and it's the hotel that we're in. How do you pronounce the
Patanwan?
Patanwan Princess.
Patanwan, except that apparently in the Thai language, it's not just the pronunciation of the sounds, but there's important tonal variation that also tells the content or yeah, it's important that you say it right. So your voice is supposed to rise and fall in the right place, and I have no idea where it's supposed to rise and fall. But
hopefully we'll get the knack of that. I mean, I learned how to say Louisville after a while.
And so New Orleans.
Louisville. And New Orleans, yeah. It's a very nice hotel. We're in the room at the moment, and if you can hear a bit of background noise, it's because we just have to have the air conditioning cranked right up. So
and
that's
the fan on the air conditioning also cranked up.
Yeah, it's good to have a fan. you know. So that's where that noise is coming from. But it's complete with voicemail. Have been able to do the net from here with the ThinkPad. And
their wall outlets, using American jargon, are very interesting in that they are a kind of international
configuration yeah.
where you can put just about any kind of plug in and it fits.
Mm. Yeah, very groovy. I think we should all switch to that system. Except
it has to have 220 volts, of course.
Yeah, 220 volts.
So it takes our voltage. It just can't cope with American appliances. But that's all right. We can cope with that because we can't cope with American appliances either.
No. Oh, dear. Okay, so that's a broad overview. Now, I'm not sure exactly how this program will unfold, but we're going to see if we can grab some people to talk to and do some other exciting things. If time permits, we'll do a bit of scanning of the band. At this stage, I haven't really found any English-speaking radio stations. I thought there might be perhaps one. I know that the BBC World Service often makes its presence felt in some countries, but I haven't found any English-speaking stations. There is, of course, on the television, some of the networks that you expect to find in hotels of this class, such as CNN and CNBC and a number of those other...
MTV.
MTV? Yeah, we don't get MTV
we
at home.
Do so.
We
I'm
don't.
22.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh. Are you sure we get MTV?
Yes, it is one below the Cartoon Network.
Oh, I see. So you get it accidentally sometimes.
Yes.
Oh, well, I have to see what MTV's like then. Oh, well. All right, so we'll leave it at that for now and come back on this special edition of ACB Radio Mainstream's Blind Line. Here, Patricia Lawrence, eat your heart out. This is the travel radio alternative. I'm sure we don't do it as well. We're coming to you from Thailand in Bangkok today. One of the exciting things about coming to Thailand is that we can talk about some of the amazing work that's been going on for some time with the Thailand Association of the Blind and related organisations. And somebody who is no stranger to the world of the internet, if you're on certain email lists, you will have seen him over the years, is Montian Buntan from Thailand. How are you?
Oh, pretty good.
You must be exhausted. There's so much effort that's gone into this regional assembly.
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm not that exhausted, but sometimes a bit tired, you know, physically, not emotionally or anything. It's just after the long day, but I could recover quite fast, so
right.
No problem at all.
Before we talk about the work that's going on in Thailand, tell us a bit about yourself and what you do on a regular basis.
I'm blind, of course. I was born blind. In 1965, I started my first school at Chiang Mai School for the Blind, the second school for the blind in Thailand, located in the city of Chiang Mai, which is the second largest city, at the age of 7. And then I finished my primary school and went on to integrated school at a Catholic school called Montfort College High School, and then I pursue my first bachelor's degree at Chiang Mai University. Finished it within 3.5 years. I got scholarship to study at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, and then I went on to receive a master's degree at the University of Minnesota in the year 1993. And when I came back, I started to work for Ratchasuda College, which is a part of Mahidol University. Mahidol University is traditionally well known in medical science, and Ratchasuda College was first thought out as the college for cross-disability group. We were able to change it to suit the need of blind people a bit by changing the special degree program at the college level to become more of a resource center. I'm working as a volunteer in the Thailand Association of the Blind, starting from being an advisor, and then ran for election 4 years ago. I was elected as a vice president and has been serving as a first vice president ever since. My first encounter with the World Blind Union was in Melbourne in 1994 when I accompanied the president of Thailand Association of the Blind as an interpreter. So that's the brief introduction of myself.
Excellent. The fact that you went to a Catholic school, does that mean that you are Christian?
No. Most people in Thailand are Buddhist.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yes.
Yeah, about 95%, I think.
95 to 96%, and a bit above 3% Muslim, and less than 1% other.
Right, but the Catholics are still running schools here.
They're very famous in running schools and hospitals and, you know, charity centers around the world, anyhow.
Okay. Can we talk a little bit about the history of the Thailand Association of the Blind? Because based on the reports that we've been hearing over the weekend, it really seems like a vibrant and continually evolving organization.
Yes, Thailand Association of the Blind was born in 1967 by a handful number of blind alumni of Bangkok School for the Blind. Bangkok School for the Blind was the first school for the blind ever in Thailand, established by an American blind person named Genevieve Caulfield. And she's blind herself, so after 20 years of the school, she started to tell her former students that no matter how many foundations and charity organizations there are in the world, the real strength to improve the quality of life for blind people and the real solution is for blind people to organize ourselves as the Organization of the Blind. And that that was the beginning of the Thailand Association of the Blind under the name Bangkok Association of the Blind. And 15 years later, we adopted the new name as the it was first Association of the Blind of Thailand, and then later Thailand Association of the Blind. It was first a single organization, pretty much centralized in situated in Bangkok, and then later started to expand itself to the region, several regions of Thailand, and then now we are pretty much in every province of Thailand. We change our constitution that it becomes more or less a federation system. We are an organization of many organizational members and also individual members. In the beginning, I would say that typically in Asian culture, a lot of people's movement stem out of the feeling to just get together, you know, to provide support for one another. It could be like a social club. It has evolved into the civil rights movement as time goes, and eventually it becomes a focal point of a disability rights movement in Thailand. And I could say without any hesitant that the TAB is the leading organization of any group of people with disabilities in this country.
And you have moved on not just to be a consumer advocacy organization, but you're going into service provision as well, as I understand it.
Yes, in this part of the world, you could not rule out any possibility, because if you are waiting for services to be initiated from outside, then you're just wasting your time. If you're not sure when the government is going to start the program, no matter how hard you push, you're going to have to do something about it. And what we believe is that as long as it is a consumer base, as long as it is driven by blind people, as long as it is not monopolized, as long as the organization itself is run and controlled by blind people, I believe that we're still a legitimate organization of the blind. Information is the key services that we provide. We don't do much of other services. We believe that information service is one of the key factors towards self-empowerment of blind people. we generally leave education and vocational training for agencies or government organizations. From time to time, we may encourage blind people to organize themselves for vocational training, and that's a unique community-based approach to rehabilitation and employment training. And TAB has been behind this style of self-organizing vocational training.
Is there a cultural issue in particular that blind people in Thailand have to overcome? I mean, obviously in Western countries there's a lot of ignorance, but I don't know whether it extends to a kind of a cultural barrier. Does such a thing exist here?
It's everywhere in the world. I think the fear of blindness is always going to be there as long as we have fear of darkness. And believe it or not, people are afraid of ghosts and they're afraid of darkness, and it's going to stay with us. But life goes on, you know. You have to really think positively, you have to find new solutions to it. Technology, more visibility of blind people, more examples of achievements, our heart campaign, our involvement in all walks of life, we are making a lot of changes. It is true that we all suffering the ignorance and stereotypes about blindness. The good thing about Thailand is that Thai people are not as ideologue as in many cases. Thai culture, we tend to, I think as anywhere in the world, to think how we could be of services to other people. And since it is combined with the idea of blindness as an inferiority, the symbol of, you know, darkness and whatnot, when you combine such a feeling, people feel like they have to take care of blind people, they have to keep blind people on the shelf. But again, if you are able to demonstrate, if you are able to persuade them through rationalization or some kind of a dialogue, you don't have to really provoke any violence at all. And Thai people are willing to sit down and listen. I think that's a unique characteristic of this people from in the land of smiles.
You came to world prominence, your organization did, a couple of years ago now. I think it must have been with the hunger strike. What was the cause of that, and what was the outcome?
As I read from the autobiography of the late Mahatma Gandhi, the hunger strike is only powerful if you're doing it in the right way, and you're doing it to show that you are willing to suffer for other people. And this is what we think, because most blind people are generally still in Thailand depending on lottery ticket selling, and whether we like it or not, because there's just not much employment opportunity open up for us yet, even now. All of a sudden, the government agency dealing with lottery tickets had an idea of converting from a traditional lottery ticket system, you know, like a real paper that people carry with them and they walk on the street or stand at the street corner and sell them. They are changing it to an automatic machine lottery ticket with a fixed price, and they could get as much as possible. If they want any number, they could it's just unlimited. So we feel that this will put tens of thousands of blind people out of work. As long as we cannot guarantee the right to employment for blind people, as long as we could guarantee that no unjust discrimination is allowed in this country, as stated in the constitution, by the way, proposed by Thailand Association of the Blind, we still have to protect this profession, whether we like it or not. And I think blind people in other countries have to do so too. I decided the day that the leading party in the government decided to approve this lottery ticket, automatic machine of lottery tickets, I decided in less than 24 hours that we're going to go on strike. I've never done that, and the result was positive, because most of the campaign related to lottery tickets have always been criticized, annoyed, and sometimes ignored by the public, because most of the times they were done in a uncourteous manner, like a block the traffic or using violence and whatnot. But that particular time, we were able to convince the whole Thai public that the lottery machine will be bad for the country, it will be bad for young teenagers. Anyone could just go any street corner and just punch number in it and just get the lottery tickets. People will be pretty much tempted into gambling, and blind people will be out of work. They will become burden of their family and the society, and the government cannot afford. So instead of doing that, the government should keep them self-sufficient. So after 7 days of hunger strike, the government finally decided to put the stop on the policy of installing the automatic lottery machine.
How many of you were part of that strike?
We started with two, and then there are four more joining us on the third day.
You made a couple of references there to the machines allowing people to take as many tickets as they want. Under the system that was operating then and that still operates, is there some sort of limit to the number of tickets that a person can have?
What they told us, it never happened anyhow. What they told us that they will put some limit on the machine that would allow a certain number, but it's not convincing, because who could guarantee that?
But what is it that stops people under the current system that blind people are involved in from buying as many lottery tickets as they want to?
But you could carry as many as your money could allow you to buy from the government. You have to go to the lottery tickets office and hand in a certain amount of money, and then you have to sell them within 2 weeks, or otherwise they will become just pieces of paper. So you're putting under arrest or under high pressure.
Yes.
Lottery tickets after the drawing period could become just a piece of paper, and you could not return them.
Okay. How do you respond to the suggestion, though, that, you know, as someone who has pretty solidly embrace the concept that blind people must participate on terms of equality with the sighted and be given appropriate opportunity, that one can't stand in the way of technological change, and that computerization of a system like a lottery is inevitable, and that blind people just have to keep pace with that change?
Well, I believe in the competitiveness. I believe that blind people should be given opportunity to compete. But this is not a fair competition at all, because the machine came with it has no guarantee of accessibility whatsoever. They had no idea how blind people could access that, and only a few individuals will be licensed to benefit from these machines, whereas this current system, any blind individual with a certain amount of money, at least, it's not a welfare, but it's a quota, we call quota. You're allowed to buy a certain quota at a certain price from the government, even though it's not really a guarantee that you're going to be able to sell all of them, but at least it's a guarantee level of price that you could buy. But if we run into this inaccessible, no guarantee whatsoever, and a few companies that are in charge, then blind people are going to be driven out. I believe that equal opportunity has to be debated and has to be understood in the manner that that we're told all things, and we were given a chance to argue for ourselves. Right?
Yes, it seems to me that in Thailand and other countries in this part of the world that people are a lot more respectful of their politicians than in Western countries. So it must have taken some considerable tenacity to make the decision to do that hunger strike.
Well, I think Thailand has come a long way in terms of that. I think we're becoming more open about our feeling towards the government and people in the ruling status. We do not often prefer violence, but we are quite strong on self-advocacy nowadays. It is difficult for the ruling people to understand why we do that. I think as it is the same way anywhere in the world, in the ruling class or ruling position tend to believe that they have already done the best for their subject, so-called subject, or citizens, but never really paid much attention.
Your Deputy Prime Minister spoke in the ceremony on Friday evening opening this regional assembly and gave a very good speech, I thought. Obviously communications with the government are frequent and effective, it seems.
Yes, in a lot of senses I think we have come quite far from the past. And we are working in partnership with government agencies in a lot of programs. But those things do not come as a handout. You know, it's we have to work hard on that. They're not handed to us. We have to really conduct lots of techniques, tactics, and negotiation. Letters of protests and lobbying, all kinds of things.
How easily accessible are politicians, decision makers in Thailand? Can you sort of ring up and make an appointment to go and see them?
It varies. Some people are that way. You could just call up their mobile phone and that's it. But some people you have to wait for a month.
And that's nothing to do with status, it's just to do with the way they choose to operate, is it?
Both.
Yeah. Okay. The issue of technology, you said something in your report yesterday that really fascinated me, and maybe at some point we need to talk about this on a main menu show, but you're working with people on the development of a Thai screen reader and speech synthesizer. That sounds really exciting.
Yes, we have been engaged in several technology development projects. When I came back from the United States, I heard that one professor at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok was actually working on a synthetic speech. The purpose is to train minority groups in Thailand who are not ethnically Thai, but they are in Thailand. They don't speak Thai from birth. So this synthetic speech was intended to help them learn Thai, learn how to speak Thai clearly. So I contacted her, and from ever since we started to work with her. Unfortunately, at that time we were caught up with the old style. It's a hardware with a DOS system, and we haven't even been able to finish or complete that development yet. Then Windows came into being, and we had to put that aside. We didn't really stop it completely, but we had to shift our interest into the Windows accessibility. And they were working on now what we're trying to do is to try to develop a software speech synthesizer that could work with the SAPI compliant screen reading software from the West, in conjunction with our attempt to develop our own screen reader. The reason we have to do that is that I think it would take quite a bit of time and resource to develop things from scratch. And let me tell you, and you probably understand quite well, that these GUI or graphical user interface really moves fast, and we're still running behind that. Fortunately, this past year, Thailand Association of the Blind was able to talk to the Thai Telephone Authority and get about 20 million baht, or let's see, about $500,000 to fund the research and development project in technology for the blind.
That's a good sum of money.
Oh yes.
Yeah.
That's the first time in the history.
That is impressive. What's the take-up of blind people and computers like in Thailand?
We began computer training almost 20 years ago, but pretty much all in English. So that puts us in a difficult position, because you have two layers of barrier. First, you have to overcome the computer access barrier. And the second, you have to overcome language barrier. Up till now, we are able to teach some of the English screen reading program to articulate Thai alphabet, because they contain character dictionary.
Yes.
So you go letter by letter. Doesn't help much, because you have to do, if you have to do a large editing. But if it is in English, we're fine with that. We also develop a Thai Braille translation software so that we could do the printout in Braille. We also develop a Braille table to work with screen reading software that allows us to work on the computer with the Braille display. And but all in all, you know, one thing is that most of these development has to come from blind people ourselves. I mean, there's just no enthusiasm from our side as much as we want in the area of technology that would enhance the capacity of blind people. And fortunately, a friend of mine who is also blind, trained in computer science in the United States, and let me mention his name, Mr. Wiederman Niyompon, was able to develop the first Braille translation software in Thai, and he also is a key person working to develop a speech driver so that we could work with screen reading software and using the future Thai speech synthesizer, which is coming along.
What's internet access like in Thailand in terms of its reliability and its price?
It's a lot better than 10 years ago when I 8 years ago when I first came back from the United States. I couldn't get any account from my own university, so I had to get an account from another a government organization. There are all kinds of connection system nowadays. You could get up to T1 connection. Yeah, and you could get ISDN, you could get ADSL, all kinds of things like that. But because of the telecommunication monopoly, I would say, by the Thai Thai Telecommunication Authority, the international connection is still quite jammed, because there are just too few gateways to link us with the international connection, and that drives the price quite high, because you know with the monopoly. We are hoping that within a year or two, when the new Telecommunication Act is out, and the necessity to liberalize the telecommunication industry will help bring the price down. One of the things is that the accessibility is not been aware much yet in this country. So you see, I would say over 80% of the websites in Thailand or in Thai are not accessible at all.
Actually, I noticed that even looking at some of the Thailand tourism information that emanates from here, most of the pages don't have alt text.
No, not at all.
Yeah. The internet service provider market, though, must be reasonably active, because I have a little program on my machine because of all the travelling I do, and it asks me what country am I in, and then it asks me the city, and it comes up with a list, and I think I counted about 12 or 13 ISPs that it said I could connect to.
Yes. Yeah. It's being opened up quite a bit, the industry. The only problem is the international connection.
Right.
So within Thailand itself, we have been able to see a lot of a competitive market that drives the price down. One thing, though, I'd like to share with you is that the Thailand Association of the Blind figured out that internet and is one of a few tools that blind people could have equal access to information. So we started a community-based internet service 3 years ago. And we gave very basic internet services to our member with a very low price, so that they could have a chance to enter the internet.
And that's still going?
Yeah, that's still going.
That's great. That's a fantastic initiative. Just in terms of what we're talking, you've got three cellular networks. While we're on the subject of telecommunications, I see you've got three GSM networks. Anyway, I don't know whether you've got any other sort of cellular.
But yeah, we have GSM, and we have the old analog system.
Right.
And I think we're gonna initiate a new system pretty soon.
I was reading about that in the Bangkok Post actually a few weeks ago. That Thailand is looking at a CDMA network, which is the sort that's used in the US and some other countries. Somebody, I don't know if it was the Prime Minister or someone, wasn't very impressed with that idea, but anyway, so you might be getting that as well. A lot of blind people get their information from radio, so can you tell us a bit about what the radio scene is like in Thailand? I guess as a non-Thai speaker, I noticed there's not, I thought there might be maybe one or two English speaking stations, but I haven't found any, so it's an interesting thing.
Yes, there are a few English-speaking radio stations in Bangkok, and you probably could imagine the whole dial, are filled with stations. We love to have many stations.
It's busy, yes, it is. Yeah. It's like Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yes. In the past, they are all controlled by the government agencies and the military. And then in the past 20 years, they are being transferred, but not given, to private business. They just rent the station from the military and the government agencies. So these military and the government agencies are acting like a broker. Under the new constitution, which was enacted in 1997, these things are to be changed, and we have to reform the media, the whole radio and television and telecommunication completely. And as a result, we had enacted the legislation called the National Broadcasting Commission, which I have been selected by all NGO in the country to serve as the selection committee. That's very exciting for blind people to be able to have this influence on how what direction of the National Broadcasting Commission would be. And we have completed the first round of selection for the National Broadcasting Commission. We have to send these names to the Senate House to check and to appoint those people. And then the next legislation will come up, and that's the legislation which will govern the practice of the radio and television stations. They have to be liberalized, but they have to also be categorized into different types. The first one is for public services. The second one is for business, and the third one is for community services. So things are changing quite a bit, and this is quite a hot debate among a lot of people who have been able to grab so much wealth out of this industry.
Yeah. Do you believe that the community frequencies may possibly be able to be used for radio reading service type stations? Is there interest in that in Thailand?
Yes, yes, of course. This is one reason we campaign to be in the selection committee for the National Broadcasting Commission.
Well, that sounds very positive. The English-speaking stations you mentioned, are they mainly music, you know, Western music, or do you have news content as well in English?
We have news contents. You dial to 107 or 105 or 95.5.
Okay.
On the FM dial.
I'll have to try that. Okay. We've been sticking with CNN. the future of the Thailand Association of the Blind looks very bright. And
thank you.
It really does. And I know that you've been talking about the possibility, which World Blind Union will consider, of providing some secretariat services so that the World Blind Union Asia Pacific has a permanent home. That's going to make a real difference, I think, in terms of making sure that World Blind Union Asia Pacific can make a constructive contribution to the region.
Yes, this is indeed our vision and our determination to make it true. We know that Thailand is situated in a very appropriate location and with lots of things that are going to accommodate such a goal. For example, we are geographically in the center of this region. We are surrounded by international organizations such as the SCAP, ILO, UNESCO, UNICEF, and a lot of international organizations are located in Bangkok. A lot of them work directly or indirectly in the disability field, and often the needs of blind people are not well received yet. We have to make our case known to them. I hate to say, but the other organization which claim to speak for all people with disabilities often get more attention in this region. And this is sad, because it doesn't mean that we want to be isolated. It doesn't mean that we don't want to cooperate with any other organization. But I think our needs, the needs of blind people, must be addressed, must be well received, and we must be able to have an equal share of influencing and participating in this. And I believe this permanent secretariat office of the WBUAP being established here in Bangkok will give tremendous contribution to that.
So how do you deal with the question of cross disability organizations? Are you a member of that, the TAB, I mean?
In Thailand, there's a system that is a bit different from many countries. We form an alliance of people with disabilities called the Council of Disabled People of Thailand, but the council does not have power over the member organizations. The council make decision based on common issue. And the council has the tradition that does not allow any group of people with disabilities to monopolize its power. So TAB could act upon its interests and will not be interfered by any other council member. We do not, as I said, TAB does not recognize the direct or indirect relationship between this council and this international cross-disability movement. We recognize that that it is necessary to form some kind of alliance to work in partnership, but we do not recognize any form of so-called cross-disability movement just because they claim to speak for all people with disabilities.
you have anti-discrimination clauses in your constitution. Are there other enactments that help, such as I guess an equivalent to the Americans with Disabilities Act?
We have the Rehabilitation Act of 1991. That is not anti-discrimination. It is more of a government policy to promote rehabilitation and employment for disabled people. So I would say that clause within the Constitution is the only strong mandate for anti-discrimination approach. And it is fortunate that the Constitution itself allows us to take that clause as a mechanism to ask for justice to the court.
And does it work? Have you taken cases that have achieved good results?
We were about to start for many cases, and then we didn't have to, because as soon as we made known to the public, we were able to settle the case before we go to the court. That's good.
That is good, because obviously, as you'll be aware as a keen observer of events in other countries, a lot of us are facing huge amounts of backlash as a result of legislation that protects our rights. And when that legislation is used, often blind people are accused of being politically correct, being unreasonable, expecting things they have no real right to expect. It sounds like you are not being subjected to that attitude here.
Well, I cannot say that 100%. I think we are in a different dimension. I think there are still some people who believe that we are speaking too loud, even though we are a minority of the minority group, if you were to think of us as a subgroup of cross disability. But blind people tend to have a stronger point of view about civil rights and our demand for equal treatment in this country.
Employment, my understanding is, unless I'm hopelessly out of date, that still the vast majority of blind people who are working are in the massage profession, is that right?
Yes, massage is probably the second most popular profession in Thailand, second to lottery ticket selling.
Okay.
No profession could beat lottery ticket selling right now. You have people from no education at all up to people with master's degree selling lottery tickets.
How incredible.
And I mean, money.
Really?
Oh, yes.
So I'm really intrigued about this. So they buy the lottery tickets presumably sort of like at a wholesale price.
Yep.
And then they mark them up and sell them for a profit.
Yep.
And so
they're running a risk, but they could make lots of profit. It's a game, you know. You pay the money, and you have to go out and sell them. And often, if you are diligent enough, if you know the business, if you know how to please your customers, and people want to get rich. People want to get rich without working hard. If you could sell this idea to them, then you could get rich by selling.
Yeah, how amazing! And the whole Thai massage thing is really a profession, isn't it? I mean, I was talking to one of the people last night who said they'd studied for 2 years to gain their qualifications.
Qualification for what?
In terms of Thai massage.
Massage. Well, normally it takes a year to get the training. It may take a year for intern to practice, so that you could be skillful in that profession.
Yeah.
And it depends on what school you go. Some school requires a few months, some schools require over a year.
And does that make reasonable money?
I believe so. It's a mid-range income generation. It guarantees more stability if you were to compare it with lottery ticket selling, but it does not allow you to climb the height of, you know, being rich very fast, or being able to expand your business. It's pretty much a steady, you know, a steady type of profession.
Mm. And in your association, how long are your terms? For example, how long do you serve as vice president before there's an election?
2 years.
Right.
It's a 2-year term.
And do you have a convention to do the elections at, do you?
Yes.
Yeah. How well are they attended? How many people attend the conventions?
Oh, okay. Well, normally we have about 200 to 300 annually. It used to be that when we are a single organization centralized in Bangkok, the number of participants could vary. The year the election takes place, we could have over 1,000 people coming.
Goodness.
But that's very short time, you know, for 2 or 3 hours, and then they're gone after election. And the year without any election, you could have less than 100. But now, with the new system that we have to guarantee representative from each province from all over the country, we have no less than 150 every year. But still, we have to expand the participation to our member at large, because a lot of people misunderstand that once we move into this new representative system, then they don't need to come to the convention. We want to tell them that yes, we do need you to come to the convention. It's just the matter of a voting system that would allow only the representative to vote. Otherwise, we cannot control the meeting. If we have to require 3,000 or 4,000 people to attend the meeting, then you could never open the meeting.
Yeah, I'll believe it. There's so much going on. Let me just check before we conclude. Is there anything that is happening that you think is worthy of mention that we haven't covered in this interview?
Yes, there's an interesting initiative that I'd like to share with a lot of us, especially people who are in technology. Thailand joined DAISY Consortium over a year ago. And what the approach we take is quite different from other countries. I cannot say that it is 100% different. What we believe is that the strength must come from within. Again, we believe that the DAISY talking book technology is only promising if you allow blind people to participate actively from the beginning, through the rest of the process. So we begin by training blind people to become DAISY software production software expert. We have been struggling very hard on that because the DAISY software are normally inaccessible.
Mm.
They are designed to be used by blind, by sighted people, because they are the people who read books for us. But my argument is that blind people could serve as the editor, they could serve as the recording engineer. So why can't we have access to the software itself?
They're doing that in the analog world, and some of them feel that they're shut out, you know, of the new digital world at the moment.
Yes, we insist on this. We work from ourselves. We try to develop a JavaScript that could allow accessibility to DAISY software, and we are to some extent quite successful, and we're sharing this knowledge with other countries, and they are coming to see us. Right after this General Assembly, we are running a DAISY production software workshop here for both blind and sighted technicians who are interested. We're quite excited about it, and this is the first time ever at the regional level, because we have been doing it successfully in our own country.
When is Thailand going to see DAISY books being given to blind people?
We're beginning to produce quite a bit of volumes of DAISY talking books. We're not as secured yet in some elements of DAISY, such as the text synchronization because of the language problem. But we're working on it, and I hope that very soon we'll be able to convince that the DAISY is not only for the blind, it's for the public, it's for people with different types of disadvantages in print reading. Good thing is that DAISY was introduced to Her Royal Highness Princess Suintan, who was very supportive of the work that we have done, and she is a dearly admired by blind and disabled and disadvantaged group of people in Thailand and anywhere.
She's the daughter of the
king.
Of the king?
Yes.
Right. And so her influence has made a difference in terms of funding, has it?
Yes. One example is that we were told recently that we will be given some funding support to allow us to begin this new initiative to train prisoners to become Daisy talking book readers and producers in the prison. So we're going to move in several prisons very soon.
Gosh, because, I mean, that might be a bit of an undertaking, given that there's quite a bit of digital work involved in recording a Daisy book.
Yes, but we have been assured by a lot of officials who are in charge of prisons that they are willing to allow us to build many, small studios within the prison.
That's really interesting. I know that there are some places in the States that do that too, I think. I might be putting myself on the spot here, but I think Iowa is one state that uses that system as well.
I think probably, yeah, there are quite a bit, but I haven't heard of anything like that in our region or in Asia yet.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And in terms of your involvement with World Blind Union Asia Pacific, you've been re-elected as one of the three representatives onto the World Executive from this region. What do you hope to achieve there in the next 3 years?
Yes, I have to take this together with our proposed idea to establish the permanent secretariat. I think the World Blind Union has a lot to offer to the world. I believe that our region has a lot to offer to the World Blind Union. We have a very rich, diverse culture, and it's the opportunity to bring our perspective to the World Blind Union. And what I hope to achieve is to increase the level of visibility and the role of the World Blind Union in the international scene, such as the United Nations and other international bodies.
Well, it's going to be a pleasure working with you, and it's been great to talk to you, because for some time I've been really wanting to do an extended Blind Line interview about all the exciting work you're doing in Thailand. So I hope we can keep in touch on these things, and all the very best for the future.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.
Well, Daniel is with us. He's come to the World Blind Union from Indonesia. Nearly got the country wrong. And congratulations on your election as Vice President of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific.
Thank you.
That's very exciting, isn't it? How do I say your last name, by the way?
My last name is Tan Kesalu.
Excellent. And when did you start getting involved in the World Blind Union?
I knew World Blind Unions since 1999, when I joined leadership training and seminar in Pattaya, Thailand. Which was conducted by Asian Blind Union at that time.
Yes. Yeah. So you've had quite a swift rise to the vice presidency. You've only been involved a couple of years, and now you're the vice president.
Yeah, as something I've never imagined before. I've never imagined since departed from Jakarta.
Yeah, okay, that's amazing. I want to talk to you a bit about what conditions are like for blind people in Indonesia. One of the things that interests me is, until quite recently, you had a president who I understand was pretty much completely blind. I wondered if that made a difference in terms of the way that blind people were treated.
Do you mean the president of Republic Indonesia?
Yes, of Indonesia itself, of the country, yeah.
Yes, he was the past president. He is now past president, and he was a president for Indonesia about 2 years, about 2 years, but he was only adult blind. So
okay. Oh yes, right. Mm-hmm. So he didn't really take an interest in trying to improve things for blind people.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
What are the big problems you have? What are the things that you work on to improve things at the moment?
Yeah, the country like Indonesia is very, very big. It consists of more than 17,000 islands. Huh. And situated from west to east, about 5,000 kilometers away, and also consists of many... what is it? Many parts, and in different situations. So it is very difficult to keep communication with the blind, and the population of Indonesia about 210 million people, while the blind people is about 2 million. So the main problem is this country is poor. It's very, very poor. Lack of financial, lack of human resources, particularly blind people who are qualified to be a leader. It is very, very limited in Indonesia. So from 2 million may only be about, not one person. So,
yeah, very small.
Yeah.
Mm. And what's the level of education like? Do many blind people have the opportunity to become educated and succeed in that way?
Yeah, actually, education, since 1997, education has been stated as education for all. And up to this time, the law recommended that blind people can join integrated school at all levels, from primary up to the university, without any discrimination. But the problem is the school is very expensive to pay.
So it's only those who have blind people. It's only those blind people who have access to family with lots of money who can go then.
Yeah.
Are there scholarships? Can people apply for funding from agencies to get help with that?
Yeah, we try to find some finance agencies, but. Maybe we got it very, very less now.
When we came in on the plane on Thursday night, I think you were mentioning to me that you've been to university yourself.
Yes, I'm a graduate from university in 1995, majoring in English actually.
Excellent. And so what work do you do at the moment?
To pay my study, I try to maximize my potential as I took such as announcer course.
Oh.
Broadcasting course.
Mm-hmm.
And then also I joined a vocalizing course. Then this ability, I try to earn money for my study. I can be a announcer for a certain ceremony, such as music performance, music entertain, or maybe I may also be married reception, wedding reception.
Okay. Like what we would call a toastmaster, is that right?
Yeah, master of ceremony.
Yes.
Okay. So they will pay me a month of money, then I will save the money to pay the school, and eventually I could finish my study in 1995 with my own efforts and the blessing of God.
Well, that's really fantastic that you did that. Access to Braille, is that an issue? Is Braille quite a common medium?
I myself never joined any Braille training. I tried to learn Braille by myself because I've never gone to special education for the blind. I joined integrated school since primary school up to the university. So I read Braille through my own effort. But I can read Braille faster than my friends who have joined special training for the for Braille.
Why do you think that is? Is that because you've just kept practicing?
Yeah, because I keep practicing. I like reading. My hobby is reading, so my fingers are very familiar with the symbol of Braille.
So presumably there's like an Indonesian Braille code, is there?
Pardon me?
In your language, you have your own code for Braille as well as the English Braille code?
Yeah. Braille code, English Braille code is different Indonesian.
Yes.
Braille code. English Braille code is easy to understand because it has international standard. Yeah.
Right. So you've had to learn both, I guess. The World Blind Union. Let's come back to that. What? Why did you decide that you wanted to be the vice president? What do you hope to achieve?
I myself want to contribute, to try to give my best contribution to this, to my people in this region. My people in this case is blind or visually impaired people. So I know exactly that most of them are miserable, so need person who want to fight for them.
Do you think this is going to be a big thing in Indonesia, the fact that one of their countrymen has become the vice president of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific? That's quite a good story, isn't it?
I hope so. Then after returning from this General Assembly, then I will come to the President Megawati Soekarno Putri to give report that I was elected as a vice president for this region, and I will ask her support. Then her support will determiningly lead to my success for this position.
One of the things that came up at the assembly was the work that Australia in particular has been doing with the people of East Timor, which used to be a province of Indonesia. Mm. Have you had any contact with them? And I guess I'm interested in what the relationship is like now, given, you know, the tension that used to exist between Indonesia and East Timor.
I have some friends from East Timor who live in Jakarta, who go to school in Jakarta, so I have several times contact them and ask their opinion, and they said that after returning to East Timor, then maybe they will be they will work for the blind in East Timor and ask me to support them.
Yeah, because presumably now that they are forming their own organization of the blind, they will eventually become part of this organization, hopefully.
Yeah.
So that'll be exciting. Well, I wish you every success with your vice presidency, and we'll look forward to seeing how that develops over the next 3 years. How long are you? Oh, let me ask you, what have you thought of the meeting? Has it been worth coming here?
I beg your pardon?
Did you enjoy the meeting? Do you think it was worth it?
Definitely. Yeah. I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. It's great to hear the perspectives from so many parts of the world, isn't it?
Yes.
Just amazing. Yeah. Well, congratulations again, Daniel, and I hope we can keep in touch over the next few years on ACB Radio.
Okay.
You're listening to Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, and as mentioned, we're coming from Bangkok, Thailand on this week's program as we enjoy the regional assembly, the first one in fact, of the newly constituted WBU Asia Pacific region. Interesting people to talk to, and one such person is Australia's Deputy Discrimination Commissioner Graham Innes, and it's nice to have you here, Graham.
Thank you, Jonathan, it's great to be here.
You're actually here in your capacity as an Australian delegate to WBU. Have you been involved in it for long?
No, I was appointed as one of Australia's delegates immediately after the Melbourne World Assembly last November, so this is my first official function as a delegate of Australia for the WBU.
You obviously have quite a schedule. What attracted you to be involved in the World Blind Union?
I've been president of one of Australia's major blindness agencies for almost 2 years now, Royal Blind Society. In fact, I'm the first blind person to be president of that agency. And it seemed to me that I'd like to make some contribution at an international level to changing what it means to be blind, to grasp the WBU current phraseology. And when the opportunity arose, when Bill Jolly completed his term as Australia's delegate and didn't continue in that role because of a number of reasons, but one of them being his involvement with the DAISY Corporation, I took the chance to replace him.
Royal Blind Society has been going through some interesting changes during your presidency. I think that's when it all started, didn't it? Not that I'm suggesting necessarily a correlation, but
There's been change in Royal Blind Society over the last few years, and I certainly wouldn't claim the credit for all of it, although I suppose I've been involved in quite a bit. But while I've been president, I suppose the major change has been the joint venture with the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind towards the formation of a National Information and Library Service. We've been doing a few other things at Royal Blind Society as well, but certainly I think as more blind people get involved in the running of the organisation, we now have a blind person as president, one as chief executive, and one in the out of the four managers at the second level of the of management, as well as a number of other blind people on the council. The issues impacting on blind people in their lives are becoming more relevant to the organisation, and I think as well as the service provision role, Royal Blind Society is taking on more of an advocacy role to try and remove barriers within our community.
So blindness services in Australia are quite fragmented across states, it seems.
Oh yes, there are six states in Australia, and most states have two or three blindness agencies, so there's a plethora of blindness agencies across the country, unlike some other countries where there's, you know, only one or two major agencies.
Why do you think that is? Why has it turned out that way?
Well, we're a federation, and historically organisations have started up in states, and that's part of the problem, that the states play a quite major role in the way our country functions. And then the other thing that's happened is that agencies have tended to be established to carry out certain functions. For instance, in most states we have a separate guide dog organisation because of the focus on creating organisations to train and provide guide dogs. And so we just ended up with a lot of agencies. This is being addressed now, and it's one of the things that I've been involved with over the last 5 or 6 years, trying to either merge agencies or develop cooperative projects or joint ventures where there's benefits of economies of scale or working across state borders, and we're starting to get a few more sensible outcomes now, but it's going to be a long time before we get it down to where I'd like to see it, but it's certainly better than it was, say, a decade ago.
So what are the ramifications of the lack of a nationalised special formats library service in Australia?
The ramifications are that we had a number of very small libraries who were providing different qualities of service, and none of whom were going to be able to cope with the major resources which will be needed to digitise audio library services. what we're trying to do now in Australia is create one larger library to grasp those economies of scale, to provide a more equitable quality of service across the country, and to be in a position to digitise both the upstream, the production end, and also the downstream delivery end, because there's going to be some major costs involved in that. And we're the joint venture that I've talked about is moving towards that, and hopefully in the very near future we'll move even closer to that goal.
When are Australians likely to see Daisy books on the shelves then?
At the moment we're recording digitally in a couple of places in Australia. I think it'll be 3 or 4 years down the track before there's a broad availability of Daisy books for Australian readers, but certainly we've started on the upstream end, and we're digitising our current library. We're starting to digitise our current library collections. We're implementing plans to put that into place, and all our new books are being recorded digitally. So we're, I suppose, tooling up for Daisy, but we just want to see where the rest of the world goes a little bit, because the direction that places such as the UK and the US take will very much influence our market. And the reality for Australia is we're a small country, and we'll need to piggyback on what happens in the UK and the US and Canada. We're also involved in the Daisy Consortium because we want to have some influence on that, but you know, we're a relatively small market, and we have to take that into account.
So those decisions really rest around the end product in terms of the mechanism on which it is distributed, I guess. Because it seems to me that, thank goodness, there's a pretty universal consensus to standards now.
Oh yeah.
So it's the delivery mechanism now.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that Australia will follow the Daisy standards,
right.
And we're already starting to do that. That's not an issue. It's the delivery mechanisms, as you say, that we're not yet quite certain about.
So you're not quite sure if you want to commit yourself to putting stuff out on CD, maybe wait for the next generation of products, or even people are starting to talk about delivery over the net with the broadband that's out there.
Yeah, I have to say I'm a bit of a, whilst I don't have an absolutely fixed view, I'm a bit of a supporter of delivery over the net. I do think that that may well be the way we go, but there's no conclusive decisions been made yet. And it will depend on what happens in other countries.
Yeah, because one of the issues, it seems to me, is that there has to be an appliance, if you're going to go the internet delivery way, that allows push. In other words, a borrower is going to have to be able to phone up the library and say that they want to read War and Peace or the latest Jack Higgins, whatever classic they wish, and get it sent to them, because a lot of those borrowers are not going to be capable of logging in and choosing from a catalogue. It's got to be pushed to them.
Yes, I think that's right. It's got to be a system that's going to allow the majority of borrowers to go in and get the material. So I think you're right about that. And it may be that we have to have a couple of systems running concurrently, because there are going to be, bearing in mind that blindness is an age-related disability, there are going to be a lot of borrowers who won't have or won't want to develop the skills to access via the net or even perhaps via the telephone. So it may be that we have to issue books in a multiple formats, but that shouldn't be a big problem either.
You have another hat. It's interesting how a lot of busy blind people do have a number of hats, and you're a Deputy Disability Discrimination Commissioner. Are you the Deputy, are there a number?
No, I am the.
You are the one, okay.
Yes, I'm basically responsible for disability discrimination issues in Australia. I was going to say I was responsible for disability discrimination. I hope I'm not. Because the actual Disability Discrimination Commissioner who's acting in that role is also the Human Rights Commissioner, so he's pretty involved in human rights issues, and I have the main carriage of disability discrimination issues.
All right. Now, for those around the world listening who may not be familiar with Australia's legislation, can you sort of describe the key characteristics, the parameters of the legislation?
It's complaint-based legislation, which means that nothing happens until someone lodges a complaint, and it makes discrimination or less favourable treatment unlawful against someone on the grounds of their disability in most areas of public life. So employment, accommodation, provision of goods and services, education, purchase of land, registered clubs, and sport, I think, are the relevant areas.
the, I guess, international case that really got the attention of people everywhere was one Australian man who took on IBM and the Olympic Games organisation and won. That's pretty significant, because I don't know whether there's any other legislation around where the web has been proven to fall under the jurisdiction of disability discrimination legislation.
Well, the motto that I've been touting around Australia since that case is that cyberspace is no safer than the real world. And that's absolutely right. After Maguire and SOCOG, Bruce Maguire, who's totally blind, lodged a complaint, in fact not against IBM. There was a lot of pressure on IBM to change the SOCOG site, but the complaint was lodged against SOCOG, the Sydney Organising Committee for the Olympic Games. The site was built by IBM, but to specifications set down by SOCOG, so there was no real responsibility in legal terms of IBM in that respect. He lodged a complaint because the website was basically not accessible, because it didn't comply with W3C access requirements. His complaints under our legislation first go to investigation and conciliation, and the matter was not able to be resolved at conciliation. It was then referred for hearing to the Commission, and the Commission made orders at hearing that SOCOG should make their site accessible. SOCOG argued that it was going to take them something like 15 or 18 months and cost them $1.5 million, and they put this view some 2 or 3 months before the Olympic Games occurred. Bruce, on the other hand, brought equally, well, more acceptable technical evidence that it would take a few weeks and maybe cost a few $1,000s. The Commission accepted his evidence and made orders requiring SOCOG to change the site. Sadly, and I have to say, really, this is beyond my comprehension why SOCOG took this position, but they didn't comply with the orders of the Commission. They decided to fight it out in the court system. And so what happened was that we went through an Olympic Games in Australia, which was a great event generally, but also a very accessible event for people with disabilities, except that the website was not accessible. And as a result of SOCOG's recalcitrance, $20,000 damages were awarded in Bruce's favour a couple of months after the Olympic Games. So it's a very clear message to website operators that in Australia at least, cyberspace is no safer than the real world.
Now, I'm sure that there were many Australians who were cheering SOCOG on. You know, the internet is a visual medium, the world's gone mad, this is just too politically correct. The backlash that must emanate from such a public complaint as this must be very difficult, not only for the complainant to deal with especially, but I guess blind people as a whole to try and deal with.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think there were that many Australians who were cheering SOCOG on. I think most Australians followed the standard Australian fair go ethos and thought that it wasn't unreasonable that a medium such as the net, which is a visual medium, should be also available to people who don't access it by that means, provided it didn't seriously impact on access via the visual medium. And Bruce's evidence in the Commission was pretty clear in that respect, that it wouldn't, and the W3C access requirements certainly don't in broad terms impact seriously on the visual medium. And in fact, I would argue, as do many W3C access experts, that they enhance the visual medium. So I don't think there were too many. I don't think there was a strong backlash. I mean, the other problem was that SOCOG, whilst they did a brilliant job of organising the games, as an organisation operated very arrogantly in a number of respects, and so they weren't well liked by Australia generally. So Bruce was seen as a bit of a champion, I think.
Okay. One of the characteristics of blind people interacting with this kind of legislation, certainly in the US and also in New Zealand, is that blind people tend to make fewer complaints than other disability groups. Is that also true of Australia?
Oh, no. Blind people in general, and Blind Citizens Australia in particular, have used the Disability Discrimination Act very strategically. And in fact, I would have thought, well, they may not have lodged more complaints, but they've certainly lodged very careful strategic complaints. And got some good results as a result of that process.
Well, something that's impressed me about the DDA's implementation is the concept of guidelines that I understand have some sort of legal standing, but they've also served as a really good reference for other countries, actually. Can you tell us about how those guidelines work?
They're called Disability Discrimination Act standards when they come into law. We haven't actually had any that have come into law yet, although we're close in the areas of transport and access to premises. But until they come into law, once they've drafted, they have performed this role, as you say, of de facto guidelines. And the transport standards, the draft's been available since the mid to late 90s, and most public transport providers in Australia are complying with these standards, even though they're not yet law. We had hoped they would be law in the second half of this year, but a number of things have focused our Parliament's attention on different issues, and I think in reality they won't now come into law until next year after our election. But I'm pretty confident they will come into law because they're universally supported by both sides of politics and by industry and people with disabilities.
Well, what's the process for them coming into law? Are they regulations pursuant to the Act? Or?
Yes, they're regulations under the Act, so they have to be tabled in Parliament.
Yeah.
In the case of the transport standards, there's also a minor amendment that has to be made to the Act, so we've got to get a small bill through the Parliament, so that's what slowed the process up.
Yeah.
They provide... they set out how public transport is to operate to provide access for people with disabilities, and they set a 20-year, with a couple of exceptions, a 20-year timetable for public transport to comply. Most government-run public transport is already complying with the standards, and in a couple of states, they're probably 5 years down the track, even though we don't yet have the standards in force. So they've provided a very effective guidelines process. The other one in the area of access to premises, we're still drafting the provisions, but there are areas of the Building Code of Australia that are already being amended to implement the access provisions. So the fact that we have the capacity to enact standards has actually driven progress in these areas.
What's the interface between what you're doing there and the work that, say, Standards Australia is doing?
Well, Standards Australia enacts standards in a whole range of areas, and they don't just relate to provision of equal access for people with disabilities. There, they can be as broad as building standards or standards for the manufacturing of refrigerators.
Mm.
So they're a slightly different sort of standard, but it will be necessary in some areas, such as the access to premises areas, to make sure that the Disability Discrimination Act standards and the Standards Australia standards are uniform, or at least not inconsistent, and that's part of the process that we're currently going through.
Yeah, and they are doing work on things like tactile indicators, quite specific disability related stuff.
Yes, well, that will fit into the building code, and then it will become part of the access to premises standard.
Sometimes there's a bit of tension between different disability groups, especially if you're dealing with issues such as a blind person needs a bit of a curb to differentiate the path from the road, and a wheelchair user wants a ramp or an even surface.
Mm.
How have you dealt with that as a blind person holding this role? Have you had any difficulty earning the trust of other disability groups?
Well, no, Jonathan. I was the first president of DPI in Australia, so in the early to mid 80s. So as well as my involvement in blindness specific organisations, I've had a long history in the broader disability field, and so I think I've in general demonstrated that the field can rely on my neutrality in those sorts of issues. So I've had a long time to develop that trust, but obviously in the role that I have as Disability Discrimination Commissioner, I've got to be representing the views of all disability groups, not just blind people.
Yeah. There's a real culture that's quite prevalent in the blind community in Western countries, I find. There are some who are quite strong about their concerns that blind people lose out by being lumped into the generic disability model. Mm. How do you feel about that view?
Well, I think we, in lots of ways, we've gone past the generic disability model. I think it was a thing of the of the 80s and perhaps the early 90s, but I think now most governments and disability organisations are recognising that there are lots of issues where there are similarities and where we can advocate jointly with other disability groups. But between disabilities there are also key issues which are very different, and that's just not true of blindness and other disabilities. It's true of sensory disability such as deafness and physical disability, and it's true of physical disability and intellectual disability. Disability can't be totally genericised, if that's a word, and I think the drive to that, the theory, the philosophy that pressed that view has now just been wound back a bit, and whilst, as I say, there are issues that we can benefit from by advocating jointly, there are others where there is going to be difference.
Although, do you still get politicians in Australia who say, why can't you people speak with one voice?
Yes. And you'll always get that, because any politician or any anyone who's having representations from a broader group would like to see that group all represented by one person or one organisation. You know, if you're talking about politicians and the tourism industry, they work hard to encourage the tourism industry to have one council which represents them all. But the interests of hotels, of pubs, of clubs, of rent-a-car organisations and of airlines can be the same on some issues, but they're different on others. And it's exactly the same process that applies.
Are there any areas where you, as the Commissioner, feel that your hands are tied? Are there weaknesses in your legislation?
Look, I think there are always weaknesses in legislation. You can always, as with any legislative document, you can always, by experience, learn how you could have drafted it better. Mm. There are a number of such things with regard to disability discrimination legislation. We're trying to minimise those. One of them is the fact that until a few years ago, it was really thought that complaints could only be lodged by individuals and determined on an individual basis. One of the things that we're doing now to address, and of course that didn't address broad systemic policy type change, one of the things that we're trying to do in the Commission now is thinking about using the legislation more broadly, and where a broad policy systemic issue is raised, dealing with an individual complaint as a public inquiry. And the classic example of that is a man who lodged a complaint in Western Australia about a particular cinema that didn't show captioned movies. He is deaf and he wasn't able to follow the movie with his family. Now, clearly there would have been no point in pursuing the complaint against that one cinema, because cinema chains are all provided with movies by three or four movie distributors throughout the country. And that's where we needed to address the problem. So we set up a public inquiry about that complaint, and we called all the movie distributors in, as well as the major cinema chains. And as a result, we negotiated an agreement whereby now, within the three major cinema chains in Australia, three captioned movies a week are being shown in every capital city. And those prints are then being distributed out to regional areas and smaller towns. Mm. So that's broad change which we've achieved from one individual complaint, and we're trying to use the legislation in that way. And there are other problems with the legislation, but we try and find creative solutions to get around them. That's part of my job, I guess.
Yeah, and so you've achieved reasonable acceptance of the legislation, for example, in the business community, who may potentially, I suppose, feel threatened by the Act?
There are portions of the business community who really don't want the Act to go as far as we think it should. There's always going to be that tension in any legislation which is trying to achieve a barrier-free society. But I think what we've got the business community to recognise is the importance of negotiating fairly and openly with the disability community, and that's a big step forward, because once you can get to that point, then you can work through solutions constructively and hopefully come out with good outcomes.
I suppose there's a personal quality that must be required in the position, something bordering on, I guess, the dispassionate. You've got to, I mean, as a person with a disability, sometimes you must feel pretty offended by what comes across your desk, and you've got to look at it quite removed from the emotion of the situation.
Well, I don't know that I've been described as a lot of things, but I don't know that I've ever been described as dispassionate. I'm pretty passionate about advancing the cause of people with a disability.
Right.
And one of my roles is to administer the Act, and the objects of the Act certainly say that it's to eliminate discrimination wherever possible on the grounds of disability. So that gives me a fair degree of authority to go in with businesses and government and say, well, this is my function and this is what I'm aiming to do. Now, I do need to be able to see both sides of an argument, but I think that's different to being dispassionate about an issue. I think I'm passionate about issues, but I also need to have the level of negotiation skills to be able to still have that passion, but understand the complexities of working through the negotiation on an issue to make sure that passion's achieved.
So it's accepted that you have a legislated role as an advocate to some extent?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. It's not a kind of a... like a quasi-judicial, independent type role?
Well, it is an independent, quite independent role, and the Commissioner's position is actually statutorily independent. Mine is not, but...
Right.
But the judicial role, the hearings on complaints, have now moved to a separate body. They're heard by the Federal Court. Mm. That usedn't to be the case, and in fact, I think that releases me a bit more to be a bit more passionate and a bit less balanced, if you like, because those processes have been separated.
It's an interesting piece of legislation, and I'd like to see it emulated, certainly where I am. And I appreciate you giving up some time. How are you enjoying the World Blind Union?
Well, I'm finding it a fascinating process, learning a lot, meeting a lot of very interesting people who hopefully you'll make available to the listeners on your program, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Can I just say, in terms of the work that the Human Rights Commission does, we work very hard to make whatever we're doing available on our website, and the address for that website is www.humanrights.gov.au/disability_rights. And that website contains most of the material that I've discussed today, plus a lot of other material, and we think it's a site well worth visiting if people are interested in looking at our legislation and the practicalities of it, and learning from that to emulate legislation in their own countries.
And presumably it's perfectly accessible.
Well, if it's not, I want to know about it.
Graham, thanks very much for joining us. I appreciate that.
It's a pleasure.
Okay. We're just about reaching an end of this edition of Blindline. There is quite a bit more material that we will be able to bring you from Bangkok in the Kingdom of Thailand next week, including information about what's going on in the country of Mongolia and some fascinating things happening there. We also will be speaking with Tim Noonan, and he is a blind person who works in Sydney. You may remember his interview or his review on Main Menu of the Sony Memory Stick Recorder. He's doing a lot of things in the field of e-commerce and matters that will interest you, so stay tuned for that. And we also hope to get some other interviews before we leave, but it's almost showtime, and I have to put this program together and make sure that it reaches the ACB radio server on time. There is plenty of time, though, for me to say that there's another thunderstorm that seems to be brewing outside. Every evening we've been treated to a thunderstorm, and man, some of the thunderstorms can make a huge noise. So that's been quite interesting. Also, I will try and get a band scan so that we can play you a bit of the English-speaking and non-English-speaking radio next week, and some other recordings possibly as well, because I'm off to the convention of the National... it's not called that anymore. It's called Blind Citizens Australia. That's the Australian Consumer Organisation this coming weekend in Sydney. So there'll be some interesting people to talk to there, I am sure. Also, you will be able to get coverage of the Blind Citizens Australia Convention if you wish to listen to that. You might want to check out their website at www.bca.org.au. That's www.bca.org.au. The General Assembly, as I record this part of the program, has completed. That's the Regional General Assembly of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific Region. On Friday night, it began with the opening, was officially done by the Deputy Prime Minister of Thailand, and a fairly formal occasion that was, with a sumptuous dinner to follow. On Saturday, the business of adopting the new constitution of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific was conducted, and that was in a special meeting that lasted for around about 2.5 hours or so. And that was finally successfully transacted with a couple of amendments. And we then went on to the business of the Regional Assembly itself. We've looked at country reports, and there is just so much disparity out there. between the way that blind people are living. And you will hear, hopefully, some of that. You will have heard Daniel from Indonesia there talking about what he's experiencing. Next week you'll hear from Mongolia, and we hope to speak with some other people as well. So there is a lot that those people who are living in developed countries can give in terms of encouragement and, of course, specific contributions of resources. And, of course, developed countries can learn from one another through these reports. And there are schemes that are in place. It's nice to see scholarships around to encourage people to undertake higher education. Lots of good advocacy strategies going on, work on legislation that protects blind people and their civil rights. So that's all very positive stuff as well. The World Blind Union Asia Pacific is divided into three sub-regions, and they met separately briefly to talk about issues that they want to prioritise for the coming 3 years that remain before the next International General Assembly. And that also resulted in members being appointed from those sub-regions to the Policy Council. What else did we do at the General Assembly? I'm just trying to rack my brain to think about it after all of this. I've got it all written down somewhere, of course. We also had a presentation from the former RSA Commissioner, Fred Schroeder, who came to talk about partnership and bilateral cooperation between regions and organisations to foster good advocacy strategies. And Fred Schroeder always gives an interesting address, and he didn't disappoint this time. There were, of course, the elections, and I'm just racking my brains furiously. Kwak Chan Hock, who we hopefully will speak to next week, continues as regional president. He was elected last year, and that position did not come up for re-election. Daniel, who we spoke to before from Indonesia, he is the vice president, so he's had a swift rise. And greeted by the big drum roll there. You can probably hear the thunder. That's a pretty mild dose as well. I'm the treasurer of the World Blind Union Asia Pacific region now. There were three executive members, Montian Buntan, who we heard from, Marianne Diamond from Australia, and a gentleman from Japan whose name just escapes me right now. I'll have that for you. Simple. Can you remember his name, Amanda?
Sorry, I'm not very good on it.
Sorry, I've got it written down too, but that's okay. It's been a successful General Assembly. There are other events that are going on before people start returning home, although the official Assembly itself has concluded. Tonight, just after we finish recording this, and I start uploading it, we have a closing dinner. Last night, by the way, we went to a Korean restaurant, which was all paid for by the Singapore Blind Organisation, and that was a real experience. A barbecue type arrangement for the main course, very succulent meat, quite spicy. And tonight we're going underground, I believe, and we're having a big party, quite an informal gathering. And tomorrow, talking about developing countries and the work of ISCAP, which is a United Nations organisation. Then there'll be a presentation on DAISY, the new digital talking book standards, and as you heard Montian mentioning, they do have a special DAISY presentation for those who wish to learn how to operate the DAISY software on the production end of things, that is. So it's been a pleasure to be here. Thailand is a wonderful place, and I hope that you've enjoyed something that's been quite different on Blind Line this week. And we'll be back next week with more interviews from Thailand, and also hopefully some presentations from Blind Citizens Australia in Sydney this year. Until then, thanks for joining us. Stay tuned to ACB Radio.